Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the NWA Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Lowther, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The NWA Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another great episode of NucleCast. Of course, I'm your host, Adam Lowther, and today we have a guest we've never had on before, and I think you're really going to like him. I'm talking about Lieutenant Colonel Garrett Glover, who is the Chief of the Futures Branch at Air Force Global Strike Command, and this is a great thing, he's an assistant professor at the Air Force Academy, and so he gets to both work for Global Strike, which is, of course, in Shreveport-Bossier, Louisiana, but he gets to live in Colorado Springs. Of course, that means a lot of travel, but it's well worth it to get to live in the Springs. So it's a favorite place of mine, favorite place of a lot of airmen. So Garrett, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Absolutely. Happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So you and I saw each other at a war game about a year or so ago, and we started talking about just some of the things that we were passionate about. And there's, you know, in the Biden administration, there was a major effort to sort of redesign the Air Force under Secretary Kendall. And there's a lot of force redesign that was going on. Now, some of it's been put on hold, but there's a lot that's still happening that the chief of staff is sort of in charge of and pushing forward. And it's something you're involved in. Can you tell us about this effort?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Like I said, really happy to be here. I'm filling a couple different seats, as Adam said. So I'm the division chief for Global Strike Command Futures and A5P. In that hat, we're really focused on a couple different efforts, but one of the main efforts right now is supporting Air Force force design. So Major General Kunkel at HAF 857 runs force design for the Air Force. It's really looking at a 2035 kind of time frame as to what the force structure needs to look like and how we're going to compete in that environment as everything continues to evolve. And so roughly about a year ago or so, Major General Newman, the A58 at Global Strike, recognized that part of force design that we hadn't really focused on yet as an Air Force was nuclear force design and how nuclear missions were going to evolve over the coming years. And so we started an effort. We tagged up with STRATCOM, tried to understand what specifically the mission sets that STRATCOM was interested in the 2035 plus environment were going to consist of. Everybody kind of knows, I'm sure most of the audience is aware of a lot of the missions we do today. But using the platforms that we currently have and platforms that may come in the future, how is the nuclear force structure and posture going to evolve to meet the coming threat? And so we started looking across six different mission threads in terms of various six different missions that the Air Force, in particular the nuclear forces, are responsible for, and tried to understand where the capability gaps are and where there's opportunities to partner with the S&T community and make recommendations on how we can increase our capability in the coming years. So that's really what this started as. And it's really in support of HAF 857, but it's a great opportunity for Global Strike to make sure that the subject matter experts and the command are helping influence the broader vision for the Air Force.
And so, this is kind of a bigger issue, writ large, is what are these capability gaps? Because I remember in about 2014, I don't know if you've been around, you're a younger guy, but you've been around. And I remember over the course of my Air Force career that the Air Force core functions changed four or five times. And we went from like 5 to 9 to 7 to 13. But we could never really settle on what is the fundamental thing that is the most important for the Air Force to do. And my take was always that it was long range strike. That was the fundamental thing that the Air Force must do. So as you're looking at sort of shortfalls, a decade out, What are you looking at, and what are you and your team and others looking to say, you know, particularly with China, which is sort of a long-range strike fight? What are you saying, hey, this is really what we need to focus on? This is what we may have or may not have. What are you guys thinking?
Well, so I think, you know, and I'll be careful about talking too much about specific capability gaps of today. But, you know, the recognition, and this also will play a little bit in my own personal opinion as opposed to the official stance of Global Strike. But as we look at, and this is broadly recognized, but the legacy platforms that we operate with today are just not going to cut it for the indefinite future, right? We have to pursue these modernization efforts. It's critical. We have to figure out how to sustain and increase mission capability rates of our dwindling bomber force, right? If you look at the bomber forces that we used to field compared to the 150-ish today, you know, the number has just dwindled drastically, and we're being asked to do more and more. So force design isn't necessarily the initial stages of force design aren't necessarily talking about the widgets in which we're going to use to execute. It's really talking about what is the scope and type of force that we want to field so we can drive prioritization decisions and make adjustments to the acquisition programs as necessary. So I don't perceive there's going to be any radical shifts, you know, within the program of record. You know, it's you know, been under execution for almost a decade as it is. You know, our acquisition process takes forever. There still are opportunities in which we can tweak little things here or there, or field new capabilities that's going to really help the warfighter, and that's what we're really focused on, and making sure that we're not investing in capabilities that just fundamentally aren't going to make a difference in the future. So, as you're aware, I mean, the Indo-Pacific is, you know, our pacing threat. That's what we're all focused on primarily is the major rock that we have to get after. And there's unique geographic concerns. There's unique A2AD environments. I mean, it's a fundamentally different challenge than we've faced for decades and arguably ever, because a lot of the conversations with a Russian threat during the Cold War, it was just a completely different environment that we were in, and technology was different. And so as things have evolved, hypersonic weapons are now a thing, fractional orbital environment systems, cyber warfare, space warfare, like all those different capabilities have the possibility of completely changing the landscape in which our forces would fight. And so trying to wrap our arms around and understand what are the implications of that and those changes, and how can we field the best force possible to make our warfighters as deadly as possible if we ever did have to use them.
Now, you, if I remember correctly, you've just completed a dissertation and got your doctorate, so congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And I think you wrote about FOBs and hypersonics, and that particularly with their relevance to command and control. Now, I want to ask you to talk about that, but before you do, I want to talk for a minute about this idea of, you know, officers getting, you know, graduate education and particularly PhDs, because it's sort of a small sliver that do it. And I'm curious, now that you've done it and you're in sort of in the jobs you're in, future jobs, teaching, how important do you think that is for officers? Do you think it's money and time well spent? Do you think it's something we need more of, and whichever direction you, or is it just a waste and we need, you know, guys and gals spending more time, you know, flying, driving ships, driving tanks, whatever it may be. Or do you think that this is really sort of writ large an important thing to do? And maybe tell me why you think it is or is not.
Yeah, that's fair. I had an amazing career opportunity to present itself, and I've taken kind of a unique path. So if you think back to, you know, so I'm a core ICBM officer, 13N missileer by trade, did my initial time at F.E. Warren. Afterwards, I went to Vandenberg, and around that time frame is when the cheating scandal erupted in the nuclear enterprise around the 2013 timeframe, right? And there was a bunch of different efforts that came out of the analysis of our career field that tried to understand what led to that. And one of those efforts or positive things was a recognition that there was not enough expertise still in uniform that thought about deterrence, that thought about international relations, that paid attention to engineering as it relates to nuclear equities. And so at the time, there was a partnership. I think it started under PNNL, the Pacific Northwest National Laboratories, and in conjunction, I think, with AU at the time, but it's evolved several times and now is a part of AFIT through their academic partnerships in nuclear
APNEE,
but I can't remember what the acronym stands for. I apologize for those in APNEE that funded all of this. I got really lucky, right? So I was selected back in around 2015 timeframe to do a master's degree at Harvard, focused in international relations and nuclear deterrence policy in particular. Completed that, which was an awesome, excellent experience. Really enjoyed that. And then was picked up on the tail end of that while I was on the joint staff in J36 to go continue the education at Missouri State University and do a doctorate in defense and strategic studies. So I was incredibly blessed to get selected for both those opportunities. In my case, I intentionally did, so I don't consider myself an academic intentionally, because my objective in pursuing these degrees, and in particular the doctorate degree, is professional. The doctorate is not considered a PhD. Still earns you the title of doctor, still very similar. It's just a different vision and goal, right? It's application of knowledge as opposed to doing research for research sake and teaching per se. I personally didn't want to take time away from the operational mission and my operational career to go do academics and lose sight of all the things that are going on in the real world. One of the things I struggle with sometimes with other academics that have taken a long break from operational realities is they lose sight and aren't tracking what currently is going on in the field. And so I didn't want to do that. So I did all of the degrees with very few exception in the courseware, in the curriculum, in my own time, right? At night, on weekends, made sacrifices to not take time out of the operational assignments. So very unique, I think, as opposed to a lot of people that get selected to go do advanced degrees. They go take 3 years off and go do a PhD program somewhere. And then that takes them out of their career field or whatever their environment is for a significant amount of time, and usually kind of changes their career trajectory into a more of an academic track, which was never my objective. I really wanted to pursue academics because I thought in this case, it would make me better at what I find it fascinating and really enjoy in understanding strategy and international relations and all the different parts and pieces to how complex this dynamic is. So that's kind of how I got into it, was great opportunities through the Air Force to pursue this on my own time, but they funded everything, which was incredible. So here I am on the tail end of that. I would say that I am hugely supportive, both of people that get opportunities either through the Air Force or on their own to go pursue academic degrees and become smarter in the disciplines that benefit the Air Force. I think, you know, a couple of years ago, they started bringing back recognition for advanced academic degrees on promotion boards and other things. And I think that's really important, right? I mean, there's different facets and different skill sets that make up the officer corps. It's impossible to have all of them, right? I didn't go to weapon school. I didn't do some of the other career paths. I'm not tactically focused. I'm strategically focused. And there's people that are tactically focused, and we need all of it, right? I mean, everybody has a different, unique skill set. But the Air Force is not a one size fits all. Everybody's career should be different, and we should learn and manage our people as effectively as possible to take advantage of those opportunities. So that being said, I think, in my view, going and getting advanced degrees is of paramount importance for our officers and our enlisted corps. I think it just makes you better. I think if you can do it, even though it requires some additional sacrifice without on your own time, without taking away from your actual career assignments, then I think that's a better path. At least that's my own personal view, because it allows you to do both, right? I still understand the operational environment, and I still I've gotten to have all these incredible assignments, but the National Nuclear Security Administration as a part of defense programs on the joint staff during, you know, the Afghan withdrawal and the invasion of Ukraine and the strikes on Soleimani. And I mean, I was on the ops floor for a lot of that in the basement of the Pentagon. And so I got to experience all those things. But at the same time, I was building a broader foundation of knowledge by pursuing academics in my free time. So I think it's incredibly important that we continue to fund those resources and opportunities for our officers and our enlisted.
Now it's that time in the show where we have to take a quick break, but when we get back, I want to switch back to the topic of FOBs and hypersonics, because you wrote a dissertation on it. I mean, when you're down at the NMCC, and this is a, you know, I think you had said that this is sort of what spurred you into that interest, because you're thinking, hey, how are we going to deal with these? And so you've got, you know, something you're thinking and working on now. So I want to, you know, tell me all about that. But we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to NucleCast, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrence Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and we're talking to Garrett Glover, who is the Futures Branch Chief. Yeah, Division Chief at drew a blank right there. Yeah, down at Global Strike, and he's an assistant professor up at USAFA, which is a great place, by the way. And so he's working on some really interesting work, and I asked you to delve into FOBs and hypersonics and how that might affect, you know, it's an area I'm really interested in too, because I think it's problematic. So tell me about what you're thinking, what your research has shown, sort of what direction do you think we need to go?
Absolutely. So I finished doctorate in November, was defended my dissertation back in November last year. It's titled Redefining U.S. Nuclear Forces for a Fourth Nuclear Age. I won't get into all the details about what I define a fourth nuclear age as, but broadly, I think it's the environment that we find ourselves in today, right? We have two nuclear peers. We have multiple other state actors playing in the nuclear arena. And we have this emergence of technology that I think and believe fundamentally has changed the landscape for the strategic environment. And so back in 2019 timeframe, it was following a couple different fractional orbital bombardment tests that China had conducted, a lot of testing in the hypersonics arena for maneuvering capabilities. And I'd seen a lot of academic literature about hypersonic weapons and how they just aren't fundamentally different than ballistic missile trajectories, in the sense that, you know, we've always been able to reach out and touch other nations. This is just really not that much different. And I just think that I don't want to say naive, but I think that there's a use case for hypersonics and FOBs in which we weren't really paying attention to, especially when you pair them to any kind of nuclear capability. And so it evolved over time. You know, the dissertation touches on quite a few different topics in terms of how I think that we need to change our force structure to some degree and other elements. But one of the big topics is two pieces. One, the hypersonics and FOBs pose a threat, in my mind, to our national military command system, to our nuclear command and control, in a way that ballistic missiles don't, right? And so if you have a missile launch and you have a threat fan and you have X amount of time and notice and you have radars picking it up that are all facing in historical trajectories where we had ballistic missiles coming from Russia, that era is no longer reality today, right? We have our adversaries have the capability of avoiding a lot of those detection mechanisms and coming at us from angles of attack that our systems just aren't optimized to detect. And so if you have minimal notice of any of these launches prior to impact, I think that provides you a couple opportunities. You know, our entire construct and our stability between P-51 peer adversaries throughout the Cold War and mutually assured destruction. You know, we walked back from a lot of our capabilities that were destabilizing or viewed to be destabilizing, like intermediate range nuclear missiles, right? We walked back from those types of capabilities because it didn't allow either side enough time to react, and it was found to be destabilizing. Well, I think hypersonics and FOBs now re-enter us into that environment in which a president and or senior leadership would not have sufficient amount of time or fully understand what the targets were of those strikes to be able to respond to them. And so if you have less than 5 minutes notice of it before impact and that thing could have a nuclear weapon on it, it doesn't give you a whole lot of opportunity to react and to launch under attack or do any kind of, capability that we may want to, respond in an imminent time frame with. And so the other element of that is, our nuclear command control has not evolved significantly, just like our nuclear forces has not evolved significantly. And so since the Cold War, and we haven't invested in them. And so I think that there's a need that we invest in modern infrastructure that's survivable, resilient, flexible, and provides a lot more capability and assured comms to the president to make sure that we could always have, so that we always have command and control capability with the nuclear forces. And the other element of that is, our entire premise of assured second strike is that our president's going to maintain sole command and control and be able to respond and communicate with those nuclear forces. Well, if the president's location can be under threat within a handful of minutes at any given time by nuclear forces of an adversary, and we post the president's location on unclassified websites day to day, and everybody knows where the president is operating at it the majority of the time, then that gives an opportunity for an adversary to take out that individual with very little notice and simultaneously strike our emergency action message generation centers. And I would argue there's a argument that you could theoretically decapitate the United States nuclear force structure with a handful of weapons. And I think that's a dangerous place to live in. And now obviously there's continuity government, continuity operation type procedures in place to swear a new president in and all those types of things. I won't get into any details and don't in the dissertation, but the dynamics there, if you think about just, what the world would be like if a nuclear blast went off in the White House, in DC, and there were several other nukes going off with very little notice in other places in the country where we have emergency action messages being generated or could, operation centers. The reality is that it would be pure chaos, right? And so what is the reasonable time frame that you would expect to swear in a new president and be able to respond with any kind of nuclear capability? And in that time frame, would an adversary be able to unleash a much larger attack on CONUS and take out the actual counterforce strategy, all the launch facilities and other elements of the nuclear forces that would allow an opportunity to get a fait accompli? So that's a one piece of the dissertation, but it's an argument for, there's a lot of conversation during the Trump era and then during the Biden era for different reasons as to why we need to limit the president's powers for sole presidential command and control. And it should be some other kind of decision-making authority that has the ability to launch nuclear weapons. It's too risky to put that much power in one person's hands, all those types of arguments. And I would argue we're almost in an environment where it dictates us, we go the opposite direction. In addition to sole presidential command and control, we almost need to have some other construct, whether it's a dead hand, like you and Curtis McGiffin have written about, or it's some other kind of pairing of a civil military leadership that has authority to launch in extreme circumstances when some kind of circumstances have led us to devolve to a certain state. I mean, there's a variety of different possible scenarios that I explore in the dissertation, but I think it's a new environment that we have entered into in which our adversaries can reach out and touch key and critical nodes with almost no notice. And it requires us to start thinking about things a little differently.
Yeah. I mean, between FOBs coming at angles, we don't have radars looking at, or I mean, you know, the ability of hypersonics to move in ways we don't expect, or low observables. I mean, the Russians can launch low observable cruise missiles from their own airspace, come, you know, across Canada, and we won't know until, you know, Cavalier goes dark, or, you know, something else goes boom. Then we know something's happened. And those kind of situations worry me, you know, greatly as well. So it's a great topic. So it's hopefully you'll turn this into some more publications and help sort of bring light to this very challenging problem, because it's one I think, you know, that you're highlighting, that is sort of the real problem. As I think about, you know, at least from me thinking about this for the last 20 plus years, is I don't think now we're going to see the kinds of, you know, Cold War era, you know, ICBMs, you know, meeting each other as they're crossing the poles. I see us, you know, it's going to be attacks on space assets. It's going to be attacks through cyberspace. It's going to be the adversary's ability to make you dumb, deaf, and blind, and then ask you if you want to capitulate at that point. And then if you say no, then, you know, you may have further kinetic strikes. And, you know, like you say, maybe that's when, you know, the actual targets, they go after our nuclear forces. So it's a great topic to be writing about. And it's one I don't really see many people writing about it. So I'm glad you did, and look forward to seeing what else you write. So, I want to bring out Bob the Genie, because we're at that time in the podcast. So let me rub my magic lamp. And of course, right. Bob's going to grant you three wishes. So,
right.
Garrett, what is your first wish?
Let's see. So I think, because it's close to the boat, I think the first wish has to be, I hope Congress passes a budget successfully. And broadly, we have to find a way in which Congress can effectively pass budgets year in and year out without this environment that we keep finding ourselves in with continuing resolutions. I think it's, obviously not in politics, but watching the impact that it has on our national security and our inability to create new starts within the Department of Defense and the delays that it's instilling, I think it's I think it's crazy that we've only had four appropriations since 1976, 4 years in which the appropriations were completed on time. I mean, that's just a broken system. So I don't know the solution there, but if I had a wish, if we could get a couple years of budgets being passed on time so we could execute our mission, I think that would be a great start.
I would love to tag team on that, because I'm actually working on a book chapter right now that looks at this. And, you know, I was trained as an economist, so I care a lot about money and how economies function and what makes them successful and what makes them unsuccessful. And so, you know, heavy debt burdens are bad. We've got lots of data that proves that, you know, heavy debt burdens, they deter growth. They have so many negative effects. And so we're really going to have to, you know, I would love to see sort of a Graham Rudman attached to that, getting a budget done on time, and let's balance the budget. And we'll have to make some tough choices, some sort of guns and butter choices. But, you know, that would be something else I wish Bob would do for us, is get a balanced budget through. So that'd be a great one. Okay, so you're off to a good start with wishes. I see Bob, he's nodding. He says, good one, he'll work it. So how about wish number two?
Let's see. So number two is going to be kind of a curveball. I would say it's kind of outside the scope, but directly related. It was actually almost a topic of my dissertation, even though it doesn't pertain to nuclear equities, which is everything else I do. I worry. So I have a 17-year-old daughter. In high school, obviously, and watching her and her friends, and the lack of expectations in our education system, and the poor education that they're getting, and the lack of patriotism in our youth, I think is almost I would say it absolutely is a larger national security enduring threat to the nation than all the things that you and I banter about with nuclear strategy. I worry that we may have already lost the war in the long term, because we are We have an entire generation of youth that is underperforming. I give the example. So she went to high school in three different states: Virginia, California, and Colorado. And in all three states, the expectations for, turning in homework were kind of like, whenever you get it done, you can just bring it in, and there's no real due dates. The grading scales had skewed. Like her chemistry class in California, they took out all the stoichiometry and really all the chemistry out of chemistry, called it chemistry, but it was really just a basic sciences class in which you could get a 65% and still get an A. And it was just mind-boggling. It has been mind-boggling to watch how poor public education has become. And so my wish for Bob would be improve the quality of education in the country and bring back patriotism in the youth.
That's important for us to have the, we need scientists and engineers to build and design. And, it's a big problem right now. In the defense industrial base, we talk about this on NucleCast all the time. We're short in all these areas for the defense industrial base. How would we have gone to the moon? How would we have had, there's a very famous group of ladies who worked for NASA who did all the mathematical calculations. We need those folks who are really good at science and math and all these things. So I'm with you there. Okay. So final wish.
Third one, I would say, stems from the last one in the sense that I think there needs to be a wake up for the American people to understand how critical this time in history is, and that that our adversaries are making strategic moves that the United States populace is just broadly unaware of, and we're in an exceptionally dangerous time. And so, a mixture of Congress and the American people waking up and recognizing that a lot of the domestic challenges and the things that we face are only a small piece of what is going on globally. And if we don't start making rapid progress, like you were just talking about with our defense industrial base, with our education, with our capability acquisitions, we're going to be in a world of hurt if and when adversaries decide to finally make a move.
All right. Garrett Glover, it's a kind of a difficult way to end the show, but
yeah, negative.
It'll leave people to walk away thinking. So I guess we'll end it there. So Garrett, thanks for joining us on NucleCast.
Thanks, Adam.
And thanks to you, the listeners, and we'll see you next time.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrent Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Krumpel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.